Hi there, this is Andrew Weiler from strategiesinlanguagelearning.com. This is a recorded interview of myself, conducted by Sylvia Guinan, on WizIQ about how feelings, emotions and intellect affect language learning.
All the way from Australia, who takes this topic very seriously and has done some really great work that people will read about when this book is published. So we are lucky he's here today to share some deeper insights. Okay, so this is Andrew Weiler. I'm interviewing him what he has to tell us about empathy. Okay, welcome Andrew.
Hello everyone.
Okay.
I hope you can hear me.
Oh, perfect, welcome. Andrew is a speech language specialist. I met him on LinkedIn when we were exchanging opinions on blogs, and he asked me to read his manuscript. I was very excited when I read it because he has a book that deeply covers issues that I had already studied from, you know, Daniel Goleman and all of those other great educators I showed in my other presentation. And he has a way of understanding more about empathy through his life studies. So I'm going to go through some questions here, okay? Okay, something about Andrew. I picked this quote from his LinkedIn profile. If you give a person a fork to eat soup with, the conclusion they can reach is that they're no good at eating soup. Is it the case? No, they were just using the wrong tool. So I wonder how many of our students think that, you know, they can't eat soup, or how many people have gone through the system with the wrong tools. And that can remind us of different learning styles, you know, all the mistakes and all the wrong tools of the past. So many people drop out because of this, of course. Okay, now here's my first question for Andrew. What were the major influences in your life that led you to develop your present philosophy of learning and write your book, Language Learning Unlocked?
Well, that's a small question. There were quite a few, really. I guess the first one was my own sense that my life was more than what I had been experiencing up to a certain point in time. So I actually spent quite a lot of time looking around, trying to better understand myself and my place in the world. And in that quest, that's something I have been all my life, in fact, and I'm still working on that area of better understanding who I am, where I fit, and what enables me to become a better person, fulfill the reason I ended up being on this planet. So that's been a major threat through my whole life. Another thing was early on in my life, I came across some really fantastic influences in my understanding of education. Probably the largest one that has impacted me was Caleb Gattegno's work. Most people know it's The Silent Way, but in fact, if you look behind that, there's a very well-developed philosophy of education that basically says that education is not about filling a vessel. It's about kindling a light, a flame that then enables the person to actually learn. And what we do in that as educators is to more to do with that understanding of what to do to come to awareness of what they are involved in, rather than giving them bits of information for them to memorize. That latter view has been really the education paradigm that has persisted for hundreds of years. That basically you're considered to be a good learner if you can memorize, if you can remember all these things. Whereas all of us know that learning a language is far more than that. So that particular perspective has basically driven me to all sort of manner of things in my life to try to explore what is awareness and how life and how we can develop that and how to interface with skills and language. So that basically, I could go on for quite a long time, but I'll stop there.
Okay, I have more questions. Okay. So anyway, a lot of what's in Andrew's book and what he was expressing to us about his kind of lifelong quest is about feelings, how feeling is so important to our learning experience. And probably most of us have gone through sometimes in school where we learned by rote or we memorized like parts and there was no feeling. You know, and maybe some of us didn't, you know, maybe we were good at school and we were able to memorize. But even if you are good at school and you're able to memorize, even if the system suits you, you're not fulfilling your true potential, and nobody is if there's no feeling. So Andrew's book talks a lot about emotions and feelings. I asked him how they differ. I'm going to ask now. Okay, question one, emotions versus feelings. Can you describe the difference between emotion and feelings and how this has a major impact on the way we learn?
Sure. Most of the time we use these terms interchangeably, and I believe that they actually are quite different. Feelings are what we come with, in a sense, when we're born as infants, as babies, and they are the energy flows that enable us to sense or to discern whether what we're in is actually to our benefit or not to our benefit. And as we grow older, they are the things that, you know, attracted to that, or we feel warm, or we feel it's interesting, or alternatively, it actually repels us and we feel that it's not comfortable. So those are the kind of feelings that I'm talking about, as opposed to emotions, that they actually more often than not actually cloud our feelings. So those kind of emotions, because most of those are actually emotions, but these ones can cloud our feelings. So if we're feeling guilty about something or angry, for example, then that emotion clouds our sensitivity, and feeling is all about sensitivity, being sensitive to ourselves and our feelings. And so if we're caught up in anger or caught up in fear or caught up in sadness, that emotion is so strong, chance to feel what it is, what we need to be doing in that moment. We react rather than respond, and our learning as a result just gets impeded.
Yes, and embarrassed, that one clouds up everything. When you are embarrassed, you lose all sense of reality, I think. Do you think that maybe ecstatic or happy, those could be real feelings and not just emotions?
Yeah, definitely. It depends how strong they are. I mean, if you're overcome by happiness and you're sort of, I mean, that really, sometimes, you know, people can become so sort of over the top with things that ends up going into more like an emotion rather than a feeling. Feelings are usually a bit more sort of gentle, put it that way. But yes, I agree with you. Happiness and ecstatic, that feeling of elation definitely comes from our feelings at the core.
So probably there's no ambiguity, because probably with the emotions that give you an unrealistic experience that's not the true reality, maybe you feel confused and it's all very ambiguous. But if you are happy or something like that, it feels completely natural. So maybe
that's right.
Okay, question two, feelings versus intellect. How do we balance our feelings and intellect for ultimate success and life experience? Because sometimes our minds are divided. You know, we think we have to focus one way, or, you know, we won't allow our feelings to become a part of our learning, or we think we'll get confused, or we're mixed up. How do we maximize our potential?
Well, our education system, for the most part, leans towards educating the intellect. And so most of the time, the activities that go on in most classes is to do with the intellect. And so most of us have more difficulty expressing our own feelings. So to actually be successful in whatever we do, and here we're talking, I guess, about learning more, is that we need to have a balance. And a part of that balance involves allowing our feelings to become more powerful, because our feelings, in fact, give us the direction we need to go in, whereas the intellect necessarily doesn't give us direction. It gives us the assistance we need to get where we want to go. But it's providing assistance. It's not, in a sense, leading us where we need to go. It's our feelings that will decide whether something has value for us or not. Intellect can't really decide that.
Yes.
If it does decide it, then we end up being unbalanced because our intellect is determining whether we should study this or that, and that really is the wrong thing. And so we end up getting sort of lost in what we do.
Yeah, and I think that our intellect is heavily influenced or even brainwashed by overbearing parents or systems who try to push us into little pigeonholes of what we should be. And we, if we don't do what you say, we never really know who we should be, because we only follow that intellect that was given to us by somebody else with their facts. And we never, because we don't have anything creative, we never create our own facts, somebody else's facts. So people, other people are lives for us when we are children. So in that respect, Andrew, would you agree that using comics, games and movies or music, like we mentioned, all of that helps us to be creative as children or any kind of learner, and then we create our own ideas and then our intuition will grow with the creativity?
Well, they can do, but it's not necessarily the case. I mean, if we're talking about teaching, depend, for example, where the teacher allows space for the learner to express uncertainty and to express their unsuredness. So it's the relationship between the teacher and the learner which is critical in this. So what we do in the class is important, but more so in a class is whether the teacher is able to actually live with and allow to actually start exploring what they actually feel about something and to start to sort of tentatively go out there and look around. I mean, intellect can be also encouraged in that situation, but a sensitive teacher will work towards encouraging students to actually explore what does that feel for you, what does that sound like, as opposed to this is the answer. So there is sort of, it's the approach that we use in the class which I think is a critical thing, rather than exactly the activity that we're involved in. The activity is important, but it's the approach which is far more important.
That's very interesting, because I wasn't even thinking about that. Yeah, we do. I know that personally, I think a lot about activities and I think a lot about methodology, really. So you've reminded me of something very important. Yeah, it's great. I think that there's so much for us, you know, to ask here and listen to, that is, you know, we'll just go with that. So I like that, because it's something new for me to think about. Okay, intuition. So how can teachers help their students to learn intuitively? If you know, if you seem to know a lot about intuition, or you've experienced it, or you've gone into this a lot and it's in your book, so what can ordinary teachers do to hold of this kind of elusive quality?
Yeah, well, there are different aspects to this. One is that when, for example, when the intellect is dominant, intuition cannot express itself. So intuition is really an outcome of our feelings. And it's the activities that we do and the kind of things that we do with our class that enable them to experience that sort of feeling. Certainly, look, I'm not saying that intellect hasn't a place. It certainly does. But I think a lot of the problems that the students have and learners have is that they are predominantly trying to learn English through the intellect, or language through the intellect. That's on a general level. On a more particular level, just give you an example. So when you're trying to learn, for example, vocabulary, and you go to a bilingual dictionary or even a monolingual dictionary, that is something, again, that has a place. I'm not saying not to do it. But when you're going there, basically you take away that ability to try to discern, to try to feel to try to get into what that conversation is about. So a lot of my students, rather than be with the conversation, be with the situation and relax into it. And that rushing to that dictionary or being freaked out because they don't understand a particular structure is the intellect. Well, it's basically its fear, and basically it's their training that makes them rush away to try to get certainty. And the certainty comes from a dictionary or from a grammar rule. So they feel uneasy about living with uncertainty is, the, in a sense, the mother of intuition. I mean, if you are certain about things, intuition can never manifest itself because that energy to come in for them to be sort of desensitive to what else is out there. And so uncertainty is, in a classroom, I find, is a key to enabling students to start to feel comfortable in it and start to explore where the intuition is taking them with regards to the problems that they have.
Andrew, can you think of any activities?
Okay, I'll give another suggestion with regards to working it out, to try to get people, them to see things, is that over-explanation is something that kills intuition. The thing is to let students work out, to actually work through a problem rather than explain it to them. Explanation is the intellect coming in. And when you work something out, you are using the intellect, but you're also using much more than the intellect, using your senses. You're using a lot of things in our capacities to work something out. So working things out is important. Now, I'm not advocating sort of random working things out, because the teacher can actually organize a classroom in a way that's quite sort of organized where you're going to with it. But at the same time, if it's too much, and so a lot of the time it's what grammar texts or even just most texts do that. They over-focus and over-analyze and sort of make it, treat the students as, in a sense, as they were maybe too strong, as idiots, because everything is sort of so clearly laid out, where you need to give some sort of uncertainty there, chance for them to work at it. And that working at it is what encourages intuition, encourages other capacities that we have to come up.
Yes, but it's about textbooks, exactly. Like, repetition got a bad name because of textbooks repeating, as you said. And yes, and oversimplifying rules again and again, it doesn't work. Some children still cannot understand them because it just puts this wall over their minds. You know, if you just can't engage because it's overdone and, you know, they can't latch on or create something new. Very interesting. Okay, two more questions. Logic versus imagination. Oh, this is very similar to what you've said. So if you think you've already covered this, it's okay. We can just skip ahead. This question was, if a teacher is too intellectual, like lacking empathy, rapport building skills, can it harm the students? Maybe you have some example or case study or experience to share.
Again, as a learner, we have to start to explore what it is to become more sensitive and to feel what is right for us and to not let our mind and our logic dominate as a learner. But to the teacher, it's the same. And really, the big thing I'd like to say here is that it's impossible for a teacher, I believe, to encourage these kind of skills or kinds of attitudes or ways of being if they themselves haven't worked at it themselves. So if the teacher is not empathic or hasn't got a strong feelings in the way they work, it's impossible to get the students to sort of express that. So that's one thing that's dominated myself in my own life, is that I've really worked at that to become a more intuitive person and more let my feelings sort of dominate where I'm going rather than my intellect. So that's the thing I'd say there, that if we're interested in doing this, I think it's important for us as teachers to work on ourselves, really, to see how we can become more intuitive and how we can become more empathic and how we can let our feelings guide what we do in our classes rather than let our intellect guide what we do. Intellect is important, so I don't want to sort of underplay that, but it's the feelings that guide us, and it's the, like I said before, it's the intellect that can actually support us in where we're going to.
Okay, that's great, and it leads to the last question, because we've all been brought up in intellectual societies and we've been forced to think logically, which is harder for some of us than others. So how do we do this? Because it's like a paradox that our intuition or our feelings are kind of elusive things we cannot pin down. And if we try to pin them down, then we're intellectualizing something that we don't want to intellectualize. So if you were to revolutionize teacher training to bring emotional and social intelligence into it, many teachers are not trained in these basic communication and feeling skills. So, okay, but I'm asking a bit more from you because you have a more refined way of looking into this. So for us to refine ourselves beyond just basic skills, what should be done for teacher training?
Well, it's the same with this as anything else. I mean, you know, you can talk about it, but you can't, as I say, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And the same thing, basically, we have to raise the awareness of this, of the importance of this area for teachers. That's where it begins. So if you're not aware about, if you're not aware of something, it's impossible to take it on board. So the awareness raising is where it starts. And so part of my work in the past few years has been that. So I've been active on social media, on writing books to try to get out there a bit more. And the next...
Yes, your book is out a lot, very clearly.
And the next bit is that we need to provide experiences where teachers can actually start to see what this means. So the experiences really are a key for that. And so, you know, in this kind of medium, it's a bit more difficult, but it's certainly once you start to feel or suspect or to intuit that, that this these areas are important, the teacher has to then go out to start looking for themselves of how can I become a more intuitive person? How can I start to feel what I need to do rather than keep thinking about what my parents told me, what I think I should do, what friends, asking my friends what they think I should do, or asking my lecturer what I think I should do. So these are the questions that are disempowering. The empowering ones are more to do with what do I feel I should do now? And so this is a shift that that is easy to talk about, but it takes quite a while to get there necessarily. That's been my experience. And maybe others can get there faster than me, but it, my experience has been with people also I know, it takes a while to make that shift so we become more comfortable in ourselves. We become more accepting of ourselves and our own fears and weaknesses and our failings and who we are and start from there, start to build a foundation from which we can actually become more of who we are rather than more somebody else, of what somebody else thinks we are. So this is where it starts, and it's a process. Some people call it a journey. Whatever you want to call it, it's fine. But
okay, so really... Okay, it goes back to the home and parenting as well, doesn't it? And how you grow up, really. So, you know, maybe when more people take this seriously, there will be, you know, well, even today, we have this today, I suppose, on some levels of helping parents, you know, to be more natural with their children and more understand. With regard to the kind of theory or, and how they teach that stuff, but what about this? Give teachers a sandbox that we need to play with these things. You know, so if you did a teacher training course, there could be activities for us to become more expressive and that kind of thing. So, Andrew, you said you're working on this and you wrote the book. Are you going to be doing webinars or things like that with teachers?
That's one of my plans. At the moment, I'm also working on a spelling application that actually works on these kinds of ways of learning. So the application, spelling application will in seek to get students to learn through through what we're talking about. That's one of the things I'm working on at the moment. Once the book comes out, I will start to think about a webinar program, but I haven't quite got there because I've got too many things on the ball. But that's in the pipeline.
Yeah, but the point is that you might be able to accelerate this kind of... path into emotionally based teaching and learning and intuition based.
Absolutely,
and,
yes, that's my aim.
So you can accelerate that because you've gone through it, you've experimented on this quest. So you'll be able to do that for us. And then, you know, in future, it can go back down all the levels to children. Okay. I really enjoyed it, you know, because it opened up new things for me. Okay, so it's quite well with Andrew. I enjoyed all of that, but you know, I love this kind of topic anyway, and I could go on forever.
Thank you very much,
Andrew. Have you anything else to say then? Because I'm finished with my questions, and you've shared a lot, and I really want to thank you for that.
Yeah, so the major thing I can say coming out of all this that, I mean, if we want to move teachers to allow us learners to become better learners, what's important for us is to become a better learner in ourselves. And part of that is becoming more in touch with our learning mechanisms and how we actually can become great learners. And that, a large part of that is to do with our feelings, of letting our feelings guide us where we go. And then once we can do that, we can then tap into the learning powers that all of us expressed very early on in our lives. And some of us have managed to maintain, but a lot of the time, unfortunately, these powers start to degrade a bit. But they're there for anyone who wants to reignite them. We all have them. Yeah, so I was saying thank you. It's the first time I've been on this venue here, and I've really enjoyed it, enjoyed the camaraderie and interaction. So thank you very much.